CKUT 90.3 FM.
Airing first on Asheville FM, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting from occupied Chalegee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from people, projects, and struggles around the world engaging in the long project toward liberation. You can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or at protonmail.com, and send us letters at P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. This week we're presenting Scott's interview with Hill Malatino, who is a current professor of women's, gender, and sexuality studies and philosophy at Penn State University. They are also the author of three books: Trans Care, Queer Embodiment, Monstrosity, Medical Violence, and Intersex Experience, and Side Affects, On Being Trans and Feeling Bad. Scott and Hill speak on many themes, which are found in his books, plus lots more topics. If you are listening to the radio edit and want to hear the full conversation, head over to our website, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, for the full episode, or subscribe to our podcast feed on your phone if you wish. We will also be posting links to Hill Malatino's work on our website and on the podcast feed if you are curious to learn more.
Here are a couple of brief announcements. Anarchist prisoner of the Greek state, Giannis Michailidis, has been on hunger strike since May 23rd to demand his own release from prison after serving over 8 years and experiencing added cruelties for refusing to bow to the whims of the state. There are rumors that the Greek state is betting on Giannis' death and on massive public reaction by refusing police vacations in the first half of August and hoping for a crackdown. Being unable to stomach water even at this point in his resistance, Giannis is likely by now on a thirst strike in addition to a hunger strike, which puts him in a very dire situation. He's lost about a quarter of his body weight as of a couple of days ago. Sympathetic comrades are invited to show resistance at sites related to the Greek state worldwide and Greek capital, including but not limited to embassies and consulates. You can follow and share solidarity with the hashtags #free_michailidis or #michailidis_hungerstrike or #antireport. Now here's a quick announcement concerning support for Shine White, a.k.a. Joseph Stewart, who's being held in a North Carolina prison. Shine White is an organizer with the Intercommunal Revolutionary Black Panther Party. And there's been recent pieces of information coming out of the prison saying that he's being denied all of his property since his transfer to Maori Correctional, as well as also other poor elements of his treatment. It is suggested that people call Maori CI, it's Maury Correctional Institution in North Carolina. The number there is 252-653-5501. The warden's email is brett.simmons@ncdps.gov. And the commissioner's email, the NCDPS commissioner's email, is todd.ishee@ncdps.gov. And you can also reach the acting commissioner in the meanwhile, while Todd is out of town, at brandeshawn.harris@ncdps.gov. And here is a suggestion of what you might say. I'm writing with regard to Joseph Stewart, number 0802041. Upon being transferred to Maori Correctional, the majority of Mr. Stewart's property was confiscated without good reason, including books and legal papers. I wish to demand that Mr. Stewart's belongings are returned to him in full immediately. Please be aware that outside observers are monitoring the situation closely, and that any further victimization of Mr. Stewart or other prisoners at Maori will have immediate consequences for the NCDPS, including but not limited to negative media publicity and potential legal action. Thank you. So you can find that stuff all listed in the show notes for the episode if you need to refer back and check those phone numbers or email addresses. Thanks a lot. As to fundraising at the final straw, our recent interviews with the Anarchist Communist Combat Organization in Russia and assembly.org.ua in Ukraine were recently translated into German and German and Spanish, respectively, thanks in part to the transcripts being easily available for everyone online. But as I mentioned a couple of weeks back, we're not quite hitting our fundraising minimums to carry the transcription project forward. So we've made a few changes to our Patreon that are pretty exciting. Here's a rundown. There's now a $3 tier that allows the patron to access occasional behind-the-scenes content, like the hosts discussing upcoming episodes or subjects that we're researching. And every support tier, $5 and above, will have access to that, plus the occasional early releases of content. Don't fret, non-patrons. We won't be releasing episodes, full episodes, that are Patreon only. Our audience will get access to each weekly episode as it always has on Sundays. Anyway, check out the patreon.com/TFSR for more details, or tfsr.wtf/support for other ways to chip in to cover our transcription and other costs. And thanks for listening and supporting as you can. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll come like a wolf. I'm never paying taxes again for the rest of my life, whatever the consequences. And I urge everyone listening right now to stop paying taxes forever. I'm going to beef with the Internal Revenue Service, an agency of the Fart Goblin High Command. I filed my tax returns this year because I never received a second or third stimulus, a total of like $2,000. Lauren helped me to file through TurboTax, and when we submitted the forms, TurboTax estimated I'd be getting $1,400 back. You need the money, doesn't everybody? But instead of $1,400, the IRS said I get zero, nothing. They said that my dependent information didn't match. And that's very curious, since I didn't claim any dependents. It's inconceivable to me how a complete absence of any information whatsoever can somehow conflict with a complete absence of any information whatsoever. Lauren and I attempted to resolve this. Lauren sent an email describing this problem. The IRS fart goblin assigned to answering emails said that the reason I didn't get my refund is not related to dependent information, but is instead due to me being a resident alien. Resident aliens are not entitled to stimulus payments. Resident alien. So I wasn't born in the United States? What fucking country is Iowa in? I'm pretty sure Iowa is in the United States. It's on the map they hung on the wall in my high school civics class. It's right there between Illinois and, Idaho, Nebraska, Wyoming. And I think that proves I'm an American. If I were a resident alien, that would mean I got an education in some other country and I could point to Iowa on the map. The fact that I can't proves I'm a product of the American school system. Another perfect argument for not paying your taxes, by the way. I graduated high school and can't find Iowa. Anyway, since the IRS wants to rob me of my $1,400 refund, I'm never paying taxes again. And my attorney is hopeful that I'll be out in the coming year. I'll be able to have an income, revenue, and I won't be paying taxes. And you shouldn't either. What you do is, if you work a job that collects taxes from your pay, fill out the form at the start of your job and claim a large number of dependents, like 5 or 6 or 50. When you do that, the government takes out less money from your pay. Then, at the end of the year, you just don't file. Believe it or not, millions of people do it every year. We have an over-exaggerated sense of how competent the IRS is, that they catch and audit everyone cheating on their taxes or just failing to file. The truth is, a fraction of a percent of taxpayers ever even get audited. And there's a calculus as to who gets audited. The IRS never audits the mega-rich because they have accountants and lawyers. They generally audit the generally just rich. When it comes to folks in lower income brackets, there's no sense in auditing because the cost of the audit is more than the IRS collects, even if they catch you. So, the truth is, it's easy to fly under the radar and never pay taxes, especially since the IRS is so dumb, it doesn't even know Iowa is a state. Stupid fart goblins. It's been a state since 1800 and something, and has a freeway running through it, and corn. And they really have a principal duty to not pay taxes. Henry David Thoreau refused to pay his taxes in protest of the Mexican-American War. I'm pretty sure the U.S. won it, but they didn't have Henry's funds to spend on the muskets. The whole idea of taxation is for government to accumulate funds that can be used for our common betterment, roads, schools, security, the things that benefit all of us. But look at the services that government really provides. The roads are really a series of potholes, and the roads are always in inconvenient places, not where you would have built them. The schools produce citizens like me who can't find Iowa and can't tell you with any certainty who won the Mexican-American War. And as for security, if the cops aren't shooting unarmed black men for no good reason, they're probably hiding in a school hallway waiting for the shooting to stop. The services suck. And that's why the IRS takes the money out of your paycheck before you can withhold it. They know the government services suck. They know that nobody in their right minds would voluntarily pay for any of this shit. So they rob you in advance. And when it's time to give you your refund, they tell you you're a resident alien. And you can't even argue with them because the substandard education the government provided you has left you so dumb you can't find Iowa. I guess I could have somebody Google it. Oh, wait, here it is. It's the one with Iowa printed across it. Okay, that makes sense. So, fuck the United States and its crappy roads and schools and cops. Don't pay taxes. Spend your money on boomerangs and eye patches and whatever makes you happy. Let the system crumble. It's not ours anyway. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the super duper uber mega ultra hyper turbo multi maxi max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're not paying taxes, you are the resistance.
You can still write Sean at his new old new again address at Sean Swain number A243205 OSP Youngstown 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. You can find his past writings, updates on his case, hear his past audio, find out how to get his books, plus ways to contribute to his legal defense fund at seanswain.org. Psst. You can Cash App $Swainiac1969 or send Doe to us and comment that it's for Swain's defense. More info is also available on Instagram at Swainiac1969 or Twitter at SwainRocks.
So I'm Hill Malatino. I use he, him, and also they, them pronouns, and I am currently assistant professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and philosophy at Penn State University.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you specifically about the two books that you published in the last couple of years, Trans Care and most recently Side Affects on Being Trans and Feeling Bad. I think both of these books really make helpful contributions to understanding trans experience collectively. So I want to talk about those books. And also, I'm imagining, since it's such a terrible moment of trans antagonism and state violence, that we might bring some of that stuff into the discussion also. But just to start out, I see your work fitting within current trans thought about the experience of transition over against the kind of like neoliberal identity politics that thinks of transness as an individual identity. Can you talk a bit about the factors that individualize transness and then sort of your vision of like alternative collective or social ways we might understand trans experience?
Absolutely. A lot of my thinking about the importance of de-individuating the way we understand transition is routed through my research in trans medical archives specifically. So I've approached those archives with an eye towards communal resistance and intervention in relationship to medical gatekeeping. And there's a real rich history going back for probably as long as there has been such a thing as like a medical etiology of transness, of communal resistance to the gatekeeping that's informed the diagnosis and the proposed treatment protocols for transness. So what I realized doing that archival work over the course of the last probably over a decade in fits and starts is that the ability to transition and the ability to transition outside of really rigid Eurocentric bourgeois white and gendered norms has been enabled through the protestations of trans collectives in communities. And that is in really considerable tension with the historic strict medical model of transsexuality and the trans treatment protocol that's been attached to that, that, you know, historically recommended that folks go deep stealth, relocate, start lives anew, and then later on, if not emphasizing what we now call stealthness, they tended to, I think, really sort of hyper-individuate the process of transition, where it was the sort of like, I don't know, journey or rebirth that was undertaken by discrete and really atomized subjects who were considered, at least in the medical literature, and there are probably lots of reasons for this, in the absence of communities that enabled those transitions. So it just seemed like there was a, on the one hand, this history of trans collective resistance to medical gatekeeping that I think really in on the ground, very real ways, has made transition possible for so many people. And then this medical narrative of what transition is about and how one accesses it that is very hyper individual. So I just have seen those histories in tension. And I think in terms of trans experience and all its diversity, the former, right, this more collective understanding of how transitions happen, just seems more true, more accurate to people's experiences.
Yeah, and one of the things you talk about in terms of like the sort of medical interface that, you know, trans people seeking hormones or surgeries or whatever face is that they're then like, there's the one hand of trans people being kind of diagnosed with some kind of like mental disorder, but also this makes us be like seen as consumers of healthcare. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, sort of like the way that the medical industry kind of receives trans people. And then also, I guess, maybe a little bit about how you see those medical narratives being kind of taken on by trans people themselves in the kind of like trans normative way.
I think it's really important to think about trans healthcare in relationship to the broader US healthcare system. And to the extent that trans subjects are interpolated as just consumers or, you know, like patient customers of medical services, I think to some extent everybody is in the United States because of the way that our healthcare system has developed along this pretty strictly for-profit model. So that's the first thing I want to say, right? Like my argument about trans folks as consumers, being positioned as consumers of medical services by the healthcare industry or the medical industrial complex, might in some respects be specific to the US, or at least a sort of, you know, unique to the United States, or maybe intensified in the United States in ways it might not be elsewhere. But I think what we see with the history of trans healthcare is that for-profit medical system spawning transition-related procedures is sort of like niche markets for particular medical practitioners to exploit. And this has been specifically the case with different surgical practices and remains the case as surgeons develop innovations, or some surgeons have better outcomes than others and are then able to market those better outcomes in ways that enable them to increase their prices, right? I mean, so there's this phenomenon of trans surgical procedures becoming a specialized niche in the medical community. And I think making some surgeons a lot of money, right? Surgeons with long wait lists that are relatively well known within trans communities for having good outcomes. And yeah, I mean, it raises a lot of questions for me about how people access transition and the sort of lack of really radically democratic access to medical transition. So it does still seem to me like accessing medical transition becomes this sort of quest to marshal as many financial resources as possible so that one can receive decent treatment. And I think that that gets internalized in maybe unpredictable ways. But I think when folks begin to think about embarking upon transition, the stress and anxiety that attends it has a lot to do with how financially inaccessible many transition-related procedures have been and remain. I'm rambling a bit, but I think that speaks a little bit to what you're asking.
Yeah, and I mean, so like in the sort of beginning of Side Affects, you start reframing the idea of transition. And one of the things you look at is a kind of normative sort of narrative that's presented, particularly on like social media, by trans people themselves. It's like a goal-oriented understanding of transition. And you talk about how that like doesn't actually reflect most trans people's access to hormones, for example, which can be intermittent depending on health insurance and the area that you live in. So in response to this, you start talking about a different kind of understanding of transition that doesn't have a specific endpoint, maybe. And you call this the interregnum. I thought this was a really cool idea of rethinking transition outside of medical definitions, cis expectations, and these transnormative narratives. So I wonder if you could kind of unpack that concept and what you hope it would bring to trans people for understanding our own position and our own experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this critique of transnormativity in Side Affects, and it's in some of my other work as well. Doesn't come from me, right, specifically. It's not something that I came up with. It's actually drawn from the work of trans of color scholars. I'm thinking specifically of Riley Snorton and Jen Harita Warren, but also others, who have really named the way that there's a certain sort of trafficking in these goal-oriented transition narratives that are predicated on a certain degree of economic privilege, of maybe geographic privilege, if that's something we can think about, right? The fact that some people are located in areas where trans-affirming care is easily accessible or more easily accessible, and some people aren't, right? So, and also, of course, questions of racial stratification that inform economic access to medical transition. And then just questions of desire, right? I mean, the very different kinds of desires that some folks have or don't have for specific forms of medical and hormonal transition. So that's why I critique transnormative narratives. And I think it's also important to point out that when one is beginning to access information about how to surgically and hormonally transition, those are the narratives that one is sort of inundated with immediately, right? Those are the ones that, like, you know, the trans influencers that are easiest to find are the ones that traffic in those narratives. And that's all good and well for them, right? Like, I have no bone to pick with them. But I think the social media landscape that folks encounter as they begin to think about transition is so steeped in transnormativity that it's really important to point to it and say, this is not the only possibility for how to navigate transition. And the other thing that I wanted to mention that just really has informed my thinking about this, and I say this because, you know, I'm very mindful of the fact that you are in North Carolina and I spent years in East Tennessee. And in Southern Appalachia, right, access to medical technologies of transition was very, very difficult to come by in a way that it's just not if you live in the Northeast or in a major metropolitan coastal city. And that meant that most of the trans folks that I knew in Southern Appalachia had intermittent relationships to hormone use, had real difficulty finding trans-affirming primary care physicians, and also many of us, myself included, had specific trans exclusions on our insurance coverage and could not afford to pay for medical transition out of pocket. So my critique of transnormativity is rooted in that like real experiential reality of myself and so many other trans folks I knew not being able to access medical technologies of transition that we desired because of real structural gatekeeping. And it just seems like if structural change is on the horizon for some of us in terms of like what a radical trans politics might work towards, it's important to keep pointing to the specific structural phenomenon that still gatekeep transition, even if there are way more trans-affirming medical practitioners than there used to be. So this idea of the interregnum, which my partner is a medievalist and like a real, you know, a queer medievalist, so a very weird and delightful medievalist, but they've teased me about using the term interregnum because they're very familiar with it as a medievalist. And of course, the way I use it is like not that. But the idea, right, the interregnum in historical literature names the space that occurs between the rise and consolidation of state forms. So I'm like an old, I don't know, I've been reading Deleuze and Guattari for a long time since I was, I want to say a baby, since I was like a teenager and in my early 20s. And it seemed to me that this emphasis on the space of possibility that exists between sort of sedimented state forms spoke to the distinction that they made between the molar and the molecular. So I started thinking, and I don't want to, like, we don't have to go into D&G for a long time, but I just thought, like, oh, you know, there's something about the interregnum that could be a space of possibility that has something to do with more molecular forms of becoming that don't have to do with the realization of, like, a stable gendered state, but instead put emphasis on questions of process and becoming in relationship to transition. And that just seemed to me like a more capacious way of understanding transition than this journey from, you know, a beginning point towards an end point. And I also really don't know about the temporality of that. Like, I don't know when transition started for me. And I don't know if it's ever going to really end, you know, and that's personal. But I also have so many friends who I think would say something very similar about transition.
I love all that you were saying. And I mean, there's even sometimes like a retroactive aspect of transition where you like look back from your present lens and kind of reinterpret experiences that are from earlier times from a different vantage point, and be like, oh, that makes a different kind of sense to me now than it did then when I didn't have maybe the language to talk about it. I like that you brought up desire. I'm thinking like in this recent essay I read by Kaji Amin, he kind of defines trans people as people who desire transition. And I thought that was a helpful way of thinking about it because putting it in relation to desire and then that kind of process. But it's interesting also, you know, with that sort of social media landscape that you talk about, a lot of trans people have this common experience of like being inundated with these images and then sort of thinking like, am I trans enough? Am I trans the right way? And I'm sort of like thinking about how, you know, I'm in this era for like young people, there's way more information about transition, right? And access to it on sharing of resources. Like that I didn't have as a kid. Like I didn't even have like any sort of understanding of this until I was already an adult. And I think that's great. And I think that's why we see sort of this uptick of trans people, which is like posing a real threat to society. But then it's also this like weird kind of way that you can do this sort of internalized gatekeeping and also maybe re-emphasize that kind of atomized or individualized version of it. Because I know like young people transitioning without trans community in their real life at all. So I wonder if you, I don't know, I'm not sure this is really a question, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts about this kind of current landscape and how it's different for young trans people and like what are sort of some of the dangers of that and what are the, like, the positive aspects of it?
I wonder, I have so many questions about what it's like to be a trans, be a young trans person in this particular historical moment. And it's hard for me, you know, I can't speak from that positionality. I came of age in the 90s. So that's the landscape I'm familiar with. I do think that there's, how do I want to say this? I think that trans folks or proto-trans folks, right? Or maybe we can think about just this just in relationship to folks that are like gender and sexually non-normative more broadly. I feel like we often find each other, even if we don't really know that that's what we're seeking out or finding when we're young. That may not necessarily be conscious, right? But it tends to happen. And I think that that's probably still the case, right? I would wager. So even if there are trans youth that are navigating or thinking about transition in the absence of a community that they might be able to point to and say, this is a trans community or this is my trans community, I think it's very likely that folks are connecting with other sort of weird kids, teenagers, who are trans-affirming, even if they're not necessarily cognizant of the fact that they are, right? There's something I think that happens with youth that are non-normative, where there are collectives and affinities and friendships that are built that are ultimately really sustaining, that may not look like a community, right? But that are still really imperative. So I think that, well, it's absolutely true that it's important to think about how to marshal community support for trans youth, especially in relationship to wave after wave of, you know, trans antagonistic attacks on the possibilities of youth to transition. I think the other thing that I've been trying to hold in my mind to balance that grim reality is the fact that friendships are always possible and are sustaining, even in the context of really, really brutal forms of structural violence and gatekeeping. And there's something about affinity and solidarity that is possible within friendship that's not necessarily possible in the context of like community work with a capital C. Like there's something looser there that I think is actually more capacious. So the other thing that I want to say is that my colleague Ehrenheit Forsyth and I have started, just we're at the very beginnings of undertaking work on fertility preservation and trans youth, right? Researching the medical apparatus that is attempting to ensure or make possible fertility preservation for trans youth. Mm-hmm. And something that we learned in the context of beginning that work was that at certain clinics in like progressive cities that are working with trans youth, there's been this phenomenon of bringing in trans elders or trans adults to talk to trans youth about possibilities for family making, reproduction, kin making. And on the one hand, I think like, oh, that's really wonderful, right? Because I would have loved to have a trans elder to talk to about like reproductive capacity and family building when I was young. But on the other hand, the fact that that's happening through this space of the clinic and specifically with an eye towards getting patients to consider paying for gamete freezing, right? It's like, oh, this is not the way I would like to see that happen. So I feel like having some sort of more robust way to have trans youth and to have intergenerational trans dialogues and support networks exist would be very welcome, especially if it happened outside of institutions that had some sort of profit motive informing how they operate.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The thing about sort of like finding ways to preserve fertility for the future is it's like interesting because I see that sort of coming up more for younger trans people than it did for, you know, trans people coming age in the 90s and early 2000s. It's like, which in a way, I don't know if that's like reaffirming some kind of normativity, but certainly as you're pointing out is like, is helpful to different industries like raising money and kind of reaping benefits from trans people as consumers, whether or not, like, you know, that's separate from like the desires that trans people have to have kids, which I think is great. You know? Yeah. That was really interesting. Since you brought up C. Riley Snorton, I had a question that I had sort of geared towards the end, but I kind of wanted to bring it in now, just thinking about, you know, with these dominant narratives of transness, there's like simultaneously a kind of heavy racialization that we see of transness in the media when it comes to kind of spectacles of violence, right? Like the image of the Black trans woman as the victim of some kind of violence. But then I think there's also perhaps a kind of whitening of transness. And you talk about this sort of relationship of transness and whiteness in specific community spaces of healing at the end of side affects in psychedelic healing communities where you're looking, and how sort of a white trans logic can reproduce forms of white supremacy under the guise of liberation and like escape from that structure. So I would love to hear you talk a little bit about how transness can get whitened in the media or in sort of perhaps like unconscious white supremacist logics for trans people who are trying to be anti-racist, and like how we might rethink transness from a kind of decolonial or Black feminist lens, as you were mentioning before.
It's so complicated, this nexus. And that the last chapter of Side Affects is just the very beginning of my attempt to work through these questions of race, coloniality, and healing practice. But I want to start responding to this by situating myself, because I think that's real imperative. So, you know, white settler, born in upstate New York in the foothills of the Adirondacks, grew up in South Florida, and mentored by decolonial feminist philosopher Maria Lugones. So she very much informs my thinking about all of these questions and is always in the background of whatever I happen to say on this topic. But I also want to mention that both of my parents were pretty committed to New Age spiritualities, or what I understood mm-hmm. as forms of New Age spirituality. My mother was a student of Buddhism for most of her adult life. And my father is, you know, a musician and just an unrepentant lifelong stoner who is, you know, grew up reading out loud to me from, you know, magazines about extraterrestrial life forms. And I think they took like an aura reading class together at the local community college when I was a kid. So I've always in some ways been steeped in forms of very, very white New Age spirituality, that were sort of like hippie or post-hippie, really from day one, right? That was always part of like my domestic space growing up. And it became something that I argued with my family about as I got older, and specifically as I read more Black feminist and decolonial work. And the arguments started off being about appropriation, about questions of appropriation of spiritual traditions that are not sort of like white Eurocentric ones, right? But then there's also a real strong like pagan through line in the context of, or in thinking about the forms of New Age spirituality that I saw my parents and many other white leftist, sort of post-1960s leftist taking up. And I have questions about that too, because there's this way in which it seems like the turn towards a kind of like maybe a, like a pre-colonial paganism is a way of imagining a cultural space that is sort of untainted by chattel slavery and by settler coloniality. So it went beyond questions of appropriation for me, and I began to think about like how this desire to recuperate, you know, things like tarot on the part of white leftists and white queers and white trans folks had to do with wanting to find a form of spiritual practice that is more pure or less tainted by the violence of settler coloniality in Christendom, right, that comes along with that. And on the one hand, I understand that recuperative desire. But on the other hand, if you look at some of the specifically trans-related material that has been published that tarries with this ensemble of this really heteroclite ensemble of spiritual practices, there is this like really troubling world historical narrative that emerges from it that has to do with, and I talk of this is the case study that I talk about in the last chapter of the book, is specifically a group that was based in Western North Carolina in the 90s and early 2000s. And in their newsletters and in their writings, you see the development of this attempt to recuperate like a matriarchal goddess culture that was affirmative of multiple forms of embodiment, that was sort of pre-binary gender and is being recuperated in a way that enables us to become like post-binary gender. And there's also a like evolutionary narrative that gets tied to that, where trans folks are this like avant-garde or I don't know, new radical evolutionary phenomenon that's going to usher in this like, I wish I had the language in front of me of how this collective put it, but like a new world order of peace and prosperity and tranquility that is no longer informed by the violence of binary gender and the patriarchal logic that informs that. And that, yeah, it's like it's a just so story. And it also enables folks who are pulling on these spiritual threads to not think about their implication in current forms of racial colonial violence. So that's, I don't know, I'm rambling, I know. I could go on about this for a long time, but it's like, I encountered that material beginning when I was a teenager and I was trying to come into some kind of spiritual practice of my own that helped me deal with questions of queerness and transness. And I just was initially, and still I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, I don't know. And why am I drawn to it while at the same time finding certain aspects of it really repellent?
I mean, it seems like there's something like, there's a particularly white version of like a search for authenticity that kind of uses either a kind of Black cultural expression or indigenous cultural expression as its kind of form, which is like totally ingrained within a kind of colonial logic. And the way that you show that in the book is just thinking about like this, like just looking at the makeup of the spaces, right? That they're like talking about all this stuff and then everyone in the room is white, right? And so they're not actually threatened in any way of their out of their comfort zone of like an all white space, and they can say whatever they want without really any repercussions. But I think it's interesting because this does really connect with a current sort of social media trans queer landscape, which is like totally inundated with different versions of like what we call woo, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's like, yeah, it's like there's like really beautiful things and really troubling things there too.
I was just thinking about the legacy of that. If you look at queer movements that have tarried with questions of spirituality in the US specifically, I think one go-to example is like the Radical Fairies. But if you look at the history of Radical Fairy spaces, they are overwhelmingly white and traffic in so many troubling appropriations of different kinds of indigenous belief systems.
Right.
Yeah. So there's what's happening currently in the spaces of social media around discourses on spirituality, I understand, is very much connected to this post-1960s legacy of queer and trans, you know, spiritual searching that always partakes of these really troubling settler logics and appropriations.
Right. And like, I think what I see a lot of sort of in current thinking and writing by trans people is sort of grappling with this moment where we're like past the quote unquote tipping point, right? Where there's like way more visibility and representation of transness that is perhaps allowing more people to transition. But like one of the sort of maybe unintended consequences of that is like this sort of fad of being non-binary or like claiming non-binariness or using they, them pronouns, but like not really sort of engaging in any kind of transition or troubling of the gender structure. So like I see people, it's like almost like trans people who maybe previously wanted this like big tent idea are like trying to rethink what being trans means when you have that phenomenon of it maybe not even really associating with any kind of material practice anymore, right? Just being like, I'm non-binary and yet I like dress the same as like a man or a woman is like imagined to dress or whatever. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Just also just like the kind of that current moment of thinking like something became sort of popular in a way. And it's, and oh yeah. And like just the idea that if we like say we're non-binary, we're doing something against the colonial gender system, even though, yeah, what does it do?
Yeah. This is another nexus that is so complicated because I think immediately of the fact that this move to identify as non-binary but not necessarily change anything in terms of your gender presentation or and not access hormones or different forms of medical transition. On the one hand, I see how it can become sort of understood as faddish, but on the other hand, I've known so many people for whom that move was the beginning of a much longer process of transition too. So it's like how, you know, and who am I to parse out whether, you know, something really troubling and faddish is happening or whether this is just the beginning of a much longer process. And maybe if it is trendy, you know, in certain sort of radical queer spaces to be non-binary, to be a they, them, even though one appears entirely binary, right, in most other respects. I want to think that it's possible that that's opening up more trans-affirming space than it is shutting down trans-affirming space. So, I don't know. My tendency is to be really generous about that. Yeah. And I also think that questions of solidarity and affinity are way more important than questions of identity, always. Mm-hmm. So, it doesn't matter to me whether, really doesn't matter to me how somebody identifies in terms of their relationship to transness, if they understand themselves as trans in a non-medically transitioning, non-hormonally transitioning sort of they them way, or if they don't, right? And if they very much embrace a sort of like transsexual understanding of their transition, what matters more to me is the political work that they are or aren't doing, and the pedagogical work maybe that they are or aren't doing, and how they comport themselves in the spaces of community and collectivity. That seems more imperative.
This is the Final Straw Radio Show, and you are listening to Scott's interview with Hill Malatino, who is a professor at Penn State University and author of several books, the most recent being Side Affects on Being Trans and Feeling Bad, in which he explores the double standard inherent in how transness is conceptualized and how it actualizes in the real world. You can see a breakdown of their books and where to access them at our website, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, or in the show notes in our podcast feed.
The Final Straw Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
The Anarchist Radio Berlin.
from across the pond.
So it's the Anarchist Radio Berlin.
With audios in English, Spanish and German.
And please,
don't mention the war.
You can find us at channelzeronetwork.com and aradio-berlin.org.
You know, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, genderqueer was like the preliminary stage to transition, and now it's non-binary. Like, it could serve as a gateway for someone to, like, yeah, like, you used the word proto-trans before too, right? Like, it's like, that might be how you find other people, right? That give you a sort of idea of how things could go. And I think going from that, I want to talk about some of the sort of more mundane and also like kind of like granular experiences of transness that you discuss in the book. One of the things actually in Side Effects and in Trans Care, you talk about misrecognition or unrecognition as a fundamental experience of transness, you know, negotiating how we're perceived, whether it's from people we don't know or people we do know. And you talk about this as a like sort of a relational model of gender, because it's not, this takes us away from identity, right? Like, I'm trans or whatever, I can say that, but like the transness happens in between people, and the other person can give us whatever gender we end up with, whether that's wrong, right or wrong. And you talk from a personal experience in this really interesting way about a kind of non-binary moment of like misrecognition as being part of sort of your own experience. I really liked that. So I wanted to hear you talk about the moment of encounter as gendering, but also these visions that you have for building other ways of seeing and witnessing each other, particularly around among trans people.
Yeah, I talk about the non-binary form of recognition, which I think is also a form of misrecognition, and that's what makes it interesting. By talking, I think I used the phrase pronominal stammering. So, and I was just thinking about those instances where somebody gives one, you know, you're encountering somebody, they sign one pronoun to you, and then you say something back to them, and then they assign another pronoun to you, or apologize because they think they got it wrong the first time, and now they're attempting to get it right. And those moments in my biography, because I did actually identify for a long time as non-binary and as genderqueer and use they, them pronouns. This is also probably part of why I'm so generous with folks who find themselves inhabiting that space. Because I was there for years, in large part because of gatekeeping around medical transition. So it was easier to be a they, them if I couldn't pay for hormones and top surgery in social spaces than it was to insist on he, him, right? In those spaces of recognition. So I say that because in those moments of pronominal stammering, that just felt like they were dramatizing what always happened in terms of the way that gender recognition had circulated in my life. So there was something that was truer about the stammering than just the assignation of a pronoun that was then never second-guessed felt. So that, yeah, it just felt like it more authentically registered the realities of having a sort of complicated or loud gender. And then the other bit that's informed my thinking about misrecognition has to do with the fact that even if one comes to inhabit a space where they're relatively consistently gendered socially, right? And like personally, I'm in the space where I get he-himmed almost all the time as I go about my daily life. The memory of that history of misrecognition is something that I always carry with me. So even in moments of being consistently gendered in the way that I desire to be gendered, I am very acutely aware of how precarious that gendering has been historically. And I also relate to every moment of gendering as something that is contingent and in some respects still surprising, honestly, even if I could probably rely on it now.
Yeah.
And that's not I don't think that's the way that cis people experience pronouns, right? Like there's something very specifically trans about that. So a lot of my thinking about misrecognition is coming from this place of trying to think about what it means to have become habituated to systematic misrecognition over the course of one's life and how that plays out just in terms of who we trust, how we navigate social space.
Yeah. And I mean, building off of that, so like, you know, trans people will sort of set themselves their own version of like the real life test by being, you know, correctly recognized or pronounced by a stranger, right? But you want to focus more on like how we as trans people can create other ways of seeing and receiving each other, perceiving each other, supporting each other that kind of operates in a different register. And one of the places that you're really kind of working in SideFX is through this idea of T4T, which you talk about as a strategic or contingent separatism. And it's where a lot of like sort of where transition happens, where survival work and support happens, where trans world building happens. So I wonder if you could talk about that term T4T and then what the way that you want to use it to think about what trans people are doing.
Yeah. So the term, as far as I know, and this is the account that I've given in my writing on T4T, the term comes from Craigslist personals, right? So there were like the M for M, W for W, M for W, right? M for T, and then T for T was just one of the iterations of that cognate. So folks seeking to hook up with folks of various gendered experiences, right, have this option of being a trans person looking for another trans person. And then it was taken up within transcultural production as a way of naming this contingent kind of trans separatism. And I'm thinking specifically about Tori Peters' novella, Infect Your Friends and Loved Ones, where there's like a T4T tattoo that is a really important part of the plot, and T4T relationships that are central to, like, that whole book is just comprised of T4T relationships that are fraught and ambivalent and complicated, non-utopic, definitively, right? So T4T became a way of naming the kind of complex affinities and solidarities that circulate amongst trans folks, but also the way that trans folks are producing spaces with one another that make the survival of social misrecognition possible, right? So part of the way that I think about this, although I don't think I've written about it expressly, has to do with Marie Lugones' concept of world traveling. And actually, Talia May Betcher, who is a brilliant trans thinker and philosopher, has been writing specifically about world traveling in relationship to trans experience. So I want to mention her work here, but say that this idea of world traveling that comes from the scholarship of Marie Lugones has to do with not like packing up your suitcase and actually moving literally around the globe, right? But this idea that on a day-to-day basis, we move between very different worlds of sense and we are known very differently in those different worlds. So in the domestic space of my home or when hanging out with close friends of mine, the forms of recognition that circulate there are very different from the forms of recognition that circulate when I enter a classroom or when I enter a faculty meeting or some sort of like academic DEI meeting. Your eyes got big when I said DEI meeting, and mine, I felt that. Yeah. Yeah. Spaces I happen to find myself in that are deeply troubling spaces. So yeah, so those are all different worlds, right? And the way the sense that folks are able to make and the kinds of recognition that are possible are going to be very different from one of those worlds to another one of those worlds. But the phenomenon of world traveling between worlds where we feel as if we are seen and witnessed and received in ways that are much more affirming is what makes our ability to travel to worlds, more hostile worlds of sense, possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking about that too with like various stories or whatever, like experiences related to me by trans people who, you know, during the initial like lockdown of pandemic, were kind of thinking about what their gender is like when they're like alone or in that space, and people just being like, oh, like it doesn't, like when I'm just alone, it doesn't really matter. I don't think about it a lot. But which this space was also a space where a lot of people who didn't identify as trans before found the place to transition, which is interesting, like potentially an absence of other trans people, right, to like affirm that. So that was helpful for me, just thinking about those spaces and just kind of relating that back to one of the moments that you analyze in the book. Do you talk about this idea, and maybe this gets to the way that like trans people tend to find each other. You talk about this idea of trans intercorporeality. Specifically, you're looking at this moment in Casey Plett's novel Little Fish, where there's a trans woman sex worker whose client is like maybe someone who will like eventually become a trans woman too, or like be out as a trans woman. and like the kind of work, the extra sort of work that the character is doing for that person. But I'm really want to understand more about this intercorporeal reality. Like you're talking about sort of how we co-produce our bodies together. Could you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
So I was thinking really specifically about spaces of sexuality and desire when I was writing about that, although I think that intercorporeality is a phenomenon that is not necessarily erotic or sexual. Mm-hmm. But I was just thinking about how common it is for folks to have really affirming experiences around questions of gender in the context of sexual context before maybe ever actually taking steps towards surgical hormonal transition. And the reason I talk about that scene in Casey Plett's work, on top of it just being a beautiful and really, really moving scene, and also a kind of traumatizing scene as well because of what happens both during and after that encounter. I won't spoil the book, but I'll just say you should read Little Fish, in part because of this scene, because it's amazing and poignant and hard. So I wanted to write about that scene, but I wanted to write about that scene in large part because it gets at this phenomenon of being brought into being through a sexual contact by somebody who just intuitively or intimately understands how you want your body to be related to in relationship to questions of gender, that has nothing to do with how your body is actually maybe aesthetically or visually manifesting, right? But it has to do with the way that it's touched and the language people use to refer to both the body sort of holistically, but also specific body parts. And I think that there's like a transing that is possible in those spaces, or a kind of recognition that's possible in those spaces that actually does really recalibrate one's sense of embodiment, one's inhabitation of the body, in the absence of questions of hormones and surgery, right? And that has something to do with witnessing and touch and gesture and like recognition that I think actually can like manifest trans embodiment in the spaces where it happens. And that's a very different understanding of what makes a body trans or not trans, I think. But it also seems very, I don't know, just phenomenologically true that happens.
That's interesting, like the way that you put it. I hadn't really thought that way about it, but it makes me think about also like, you know, one of the things I think about a lot is like the limitations of our framework of consent in negotiating sexual encounters or whatever, and how like, you know, you might not be able to, in that moment, say, like the moment that you're analyzing in your book from Casey Plett is a moment where maybe that person's not really able to say these things about their desire, but the other person can recognize it without that language, right? And that for me kind of questions the idea of like the sort of like verbal consent model, because like you don't always have the language. You can't rely on the other person all the time also in a sexual encounter to know these things, right? But this is like a special kind of circumstance where something happens outside of being able to talk about it. So yeah, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it that way. That's really interesting.
I think it also happens in friendships too. I mean, I imagine, and this is maybe again like retrospectively imbuing meaning, right? But I just think about all of the friends I had as a kid and as a teenager who I was just, and they were of multiple assigned genders, right? But when I think about my dynamics with them, we were all just like rowdy little boys with each other.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was like the space of intercorporeality that we produced and how we navigated and inhabited our bodies in those spaces. So it happens there too, right? Just in this whole like economy of gesture and relation, where there can be real intimate kinds of knowingness that exceed, you know, questions of gender norms or gender categories that become phenomenologically really fundamental, even if they're not done justice by language, right? Like there's a complexity that exceeds languages in those interactions that I find really important to think about, which is part of why I think like trans phenomenology is a subspecialization, right? Is so interesting.
That's sort of what I was sort of talking about when I was saying there's that retroactive aspect of transness, that like when I use that word to understand myself, I could go back and be like, all these things fall in place in a certain way that like I couldn't put together before, but now I can. And then you can start saying, like, this was the logic underlying that I was, like, unconsciously seeking out something, and other people could see it without also having to say it, you know, because there wasn't a space for it, maybe. Yeah, I love that way that you were talking about that. But okay, so also just thinking about sort of the T4T kind of, you know, community among trans people, one thing that I think is super important that you talk about is not idealizing our understanding of trans people, but like when we talk about this instead.
Bang a langer.